You have an English accent. Where did you acquire that, as if I didn't know?
I was born in Britain, and then I went as an immigrant to Canada after the war, when I came out of the RAF, and then I've lived in the Bahamas for 20 years. I come in and out of the United States. When I go back to Britain, people I meet think I'm American, but Americans don't hear it that way. I guess it's a mixture.
Yeah, it's kind of an amalgam of an accent in some respects.
But it isn't strived for particularly.
Have you ever heard? Have you ever listened to Paul Theroux? He's a writer novelist.
No, I know his name. Of course, I've never heard him.
He was born in Massachusetts, but you hear him speak, you would swear that he's almost English, but not quite. He lives in England and is married to an English wife, and it's interesting, his accent. People really can't place it, but he is. He's a French-Canadian from Massachusetts.
You're not recording now, are you?
Yes, I'm recording.
Oh, okay. Oh.
You're not worried?
No, because I was going to give you a little limitation, and I really wouldn't want to use the... I don't want you to use it on the air.
No.
Well, I was born in England in a town called Luton, see, and when I went to school, this is the way the kids talk when they went, and the women went to the app factories to work. And my mum bought a wireless, and she sat me in front of, that's what you call radio, you see, and she said, "You listen to these blokes up in smoke." That was London, and that was the announcers, and said, you got to talk like them, not the way you do now.
Okay.
And I did my best.
Yeah, you overcame the regionalism, didn't you? in fact, my family, most of them are from Oklahoma, and they always talk like this, and they always end their sentences up a little bit like this. Kind of talk deep, but end all their sentences up like this. So I, too, had to go through some metamorphosis in some respects. Well, let's talk about you. You mentioned growing up in England. Well, how old were you when you went to Canada?
I was 1947... I guess I was 27. I'd just come out of the RAF. I'd been in the RAF during World War II.
Tell me about your family. Was there any inkling as you were growing up, other than listening to the BBC and the radio, that you might someday be a writer?
I'd always wanted to be a writer, a reporter, a news reporter, which is what I wanted for as long as I can remember. And I was asked recently if I had any idea where I got my storytelling acumen, if that's the right word. And I know it was from my mother, who used to tell me stories when I was a small boy, and when she came to visit us when our own children, my children, were growing up, she told stories too, and she'd write letters which were entertaining. Her education finished at 12, she never had any opportunity to put that ability into effect, but I know that's where I got it.
Mm-hmm. What did you do when you went to Canada?
Look for a job.
And,
the only thing I knew at that point was how to fly an airplane. And I'd always wanted to be a reporter on a newspaper. I had, during the war, had a few things published, short stories. And the end of my Air Force tenure, I was the editor of a new technical magazine for pilots coming into the RAF. But I hadn't had any reporting experience. I went around to the newspapers in Toronto, the three major papers, and told them I'd like a job as a reporter and showed them what I'd had published, and the answer was identical. Without reporting experience, you can't get a job as a reporter. The catch-22, of course, catch-22 wasn't in vogue at that time, but was if you can't get a job, how do you get the experience? I never did find out.
No, if it's the way with broadcasters, they all want experienced broadcasters, but where do you start? Well, I can tell you where they start. They start in very small stations right out of college and rarely make very much money. That's the way they do it. Most people put in their time and their dues. Well, how did you finally get a newspaper job?
No, I worked for a publishing company. I got a job as an assistant editor on a magazine, a technical magazine. I did have some technical background because of my Air Force training. And I was the assistant editor, then later the editor of a magazine called Bus and Truck Transport. I spent 5 years with that company, in the course of which I met my wife Sheila, and we were married in 1951. And there were 5 good years. Then I went on from there into industry, and by that time I had mentally given up the idea of writing. Fiction was what I wanted to do, and I'd never been able to make a breakthrough.
But you did make a breakthrough. How did that happen?
It happened because I was doing quite well in industry and sales, and on a flight back from Vancouver to Toronto, where I was living, it was a noisy airplane. They were called North Stars. No one ever went to sleep on them. It was totally impossible. And I daydreamed a story, and then I thought, hey, that's a play. And it was called Flight into Danger, and it was about a rusty old wartime pilot, and mentally that was me. And the pilots, for some reason, were incapacitated, and the question was, could he take over? Well, it was a Friday night, and in those days, Catholics had fish on Friday. It was before the dispensation, and other people had meat, and I'd had meat, and I got to thinking, well, supposing the pilots had fish, could I fly this airplane? I'd only flown fighters, and this was a big, by standards in those days, four-engined airplane. And anyway, when I got on the ground, my wife Sheila met me in Toronto, and I said, I've got an idea for a play. I'm going to write it. I wrote it, put it in the mail, and my life turned over.
What happened?
Well, it was performed in Canada. It was tremendously successful. And then it was bought by NBC in the United States. And subsequently, I wrote other plays. I wrote for CBS. I wrote The Last Studio One for CBS, which came out of New York. I got an Emmy nomination for that. And I was asked by a publishing house, Doubleday, my present publishers, if I'd consider writing it as a book. I hadn't thought up to that point that I could write a book. Anyway, I tried. It became a novel, The Final Diagnosis, which is still around. That's how it all started.
Mm. And you have now written, let's see here, you're putting your credits.
I think it adds up to 10.
And some well-known ones, such as Airport, Hotel. One thing that struck me with the evening news is you really do your research.
I take a year. I do nothing else but research. I travel, and I try to get inside the minds of the people I'm writing about. Everything I do on a totally off-the-record basis. If I were coming to you, for example, I'd say, I'd like to hear about your work, how you got here, what you do. But everything you tell me is off the record, and I won't tell people where I've been or who I've talked to. And as a fiction writer, I can change and shape anything I learn and I'm going to use, unlike a news person who must quote directly. And people trust me. And that's how I get my information. Also by patience, by just sitting around and watching, observing. In the case of the evening news, I went to networks, which I will not name, and I spent time with them and news bureaus across the United States. I went to Britain. Time with British news people, and I went on the continent. I went to Vienna, actually, with a U.S. network crew, just being with them for a few days while they were covering a major story. I also, because part of the evening news is set in Peru, I also went to Peru to do research there. I went twice, and additionally went to Britain again to do anti-terrorist course, a very intensive week in which I learned a lot about terrorists and terrorism.
Yeah, I can see you actually went to all these places, Teterboro Airport, Hackensack, White Plains, various locations throughout Manhattan, and you don't even live in Manhattan, but you really have the locations, don't
you? No, but I'm very comfortable in the United States. A lot of people think that because I write about the American scene, I am an American. Actually, I'm still British, and I'm also Canadian as well, and a permanent resident of the Bahamas, which is home. But my stories are about the U.S., and I have a feeling that perhaps because, in one sense, I'm an outsider, I'm more objective. But on the whole, my books are pretty admiring. I see this country with its warts and its weaknesses. No perfect country anywhere. But I enjoy writing about it.
Well, I learned things about television broadcast news that even I didn't know. And I've been in television news and at CBS for many years, such things as the rim, the horseshoe, where people sit at the assignment desk. I didn't even know they had names. But now you must have gone to CBS though and observed.
I'm going to I'm going to invoke my off the record promise to all the people I saw that I don't say which networks it was, and I don't say whom I saw. And it's my stock in trade, something I'm very conscientious about.
Well, in the evening news, the network, which is
CBA. That's ABC backwards, not quite CBS right, or NBC.
Right. But it's got a production center in this particular instance on the east side rather than the west side. It has a headquarters.
It's called Stonehenge.
The headquarters office called Black Rock. It's called Stonehenge. So there are a lot of similarities. But I can see that it's probably an amalgam of all of the networks in many respects.
It is an amalgam, and it's an amalgam of people, too. And with this book particularly, because I knew this would be the focus of attention in that regard, I went out of my way to combine personalities. Oh, sure, parts of personalities of people whom I've met, some of whom I've gotten to know quite well. And there are portions in that book where people will recognize themselves and things they told me. Of course, if they choose to say that that is them, I'll confirm it gladly, but they must say it first if they wish.
Well, the story opens with a mid-air plane collision near the Dallas-Fort Worth airport. Did you happen to be on the spot when such a plane came down?
No. But that's not difficult to research that, and there have been one or two incidents. Actually, I have a son who was working for American Airlines at Dallas, and he helped me with the background there.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the story and its basic premise, because it deals with terrorism. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes, I've written, as you know, about terrorism in Peru, Sendero Luminoso, The Shining Path. And when I started to plan a book about television news, I felt that terrorism logically would be an ingredient because it's so much in the news these days. And I took advice from a young television producer whom I know, a close personal friend, and I said, I want to write about terrorism, but I'm hesitant about writing concerning the Middle East. So much has been written. I wouldn't use the word cliche, but I would like to set my terrorism somewhere else. Remember, this is 4 years ago, and he said, The Shining Path, Sendero Luminoso, Peru. By the time your book comes out, they'll be in the news almost daily. Well, he was right, by golly. And then later, having done little reading myself, because at that point I hadn't heard of them either, I decided I would go to Peru, and I made an arrangement. He got time off and came with me. We also hired a young woman there who was well informed about the area, and she escorted us to places where Sendero Luminoso was operating, but not so close that we would be immediate to them, because people have said to me, knowing I went to Peru, did you interview Sendero Luminoso? And my answer is that you don't interview them and come back alive. And one of the places I wanted to go, I made two trips. I wanted to go on the first trip was Ayacucho, which was where Sendero Luminoso had its beginnings. And the Peru government, which knew through the our woman contact there that what I was going to do, said no, because they'd had three journalists killed just a few weeks before by Sendero, and I didn't argue about that. But I went to Cusco, to the high Andes, and on a subsequent trip went into the jungle, which I've described. The reason for that is that when I do a book, I try and get what I call the sound, the sight, the taste, the smell. And only if I see it myself and experience it myself can I describe that to readers.
Well, you certainly did that. Well, the story, of course, deals with the family of a network television anchorman. The family is kidnapped, and I don't think I'm going to give away too much if I say that they are smuggled out of the country in coffins and taken to Peru. And the purpose, of course, is for the terrorists to hold, in effect, the network hostage and use that as a pawn to get across their message. You selected television people, but you could have selected politicians, couldn't you, or anybody. Why did you decide to use the television people?
Well, actually, the television aspect came first. I decided before anything else that I wanted to write a book about news and about television news. And I wondered sometimes why I didn't write it years ago, because I'm a newsaholic. Even as a small boy, I've been fascinated by news. I wanted to be a part of it, but never was, for a variety of reasons. And I think that television news has changed the nature of news in several ways, advantageously. For example, television has taken people to places which in the old days, when there was just the print press and even just radio, that they wouldn't see. Even last weekend, those horrific scenes in London, you were there. I was a Britisher. I was shocked to see them. And I would hardly have believed it had it not been on view. Indeed, in the past few months, the events in Eastern Europe, which were so exciting, we've seen them all. Television news has made that possible. People can go into parliaments and palaces that they couldn't go before. That old cliche, a picture is worth a thousand words. Well, it's put a new shape on the news, and I think for other news media as well. Newspapers, because of television's immediacy, and of course radio is more immediate than that without pictures, but because of television's immediacy, newspapers no longer have special editions. You don't see newsboys shouting them, and as a younger man, I can remember that. I think television, I believe very strongly that television has made more people in many countries increasingly aware of what is going on in the world, much more than they did previously. I also believe that it's led many to read newspapers who haven't read newspapers before. I know I'm a close follower of news, TV and radio, of course, but I still want to see the print press the next day to know more about what has happened. The effect upon newspapers has made them become more analytical. They no longer worry about scoops. They can't get scoops these days with TV and radio. I think it's changed many things, and I'm excited about it.
Unless they're complex stories. Television does not deal well with complex economic stories or some stories dealing with certain social aspects that are very detailed. Television has to be rather blunt and rather specific and sometimes very easy for people, don't you think? There's a time element, too.
Oh, absolutely, and it isn't complete. And the point I was making earlier is that the news that you see on television has to be supplemented if you're going to be really interested and informed. But I do believe that what has appeared on television and continues to whets the appetite of people to know more about what is going on, and in that it fulfills a function.
Yeah, it's also said that Vietnam was the first war to be covered by television in the way that it was, and probably led to a lot of dissatisfaction with that war, and ultimately the pullout of the American presence.
It's interesting you should mention that, because I've often wondered hypothetically. My father was in World War One. He went all the way through, was in the trenches, and he was what was known in those days as an old contemptible. And those were the people who were in right at the beginning. And the terrible carnage that was there was really unreported. There wasn't very much of it in the newspapers. Only after World War, I said World War II, I meant World War One. Only after my father was in World War One, he was an old contemptible, he was in the trenches, and he went through all 4 years of that. And I wonder now, hypothetically, if that had been seen, whether that carnage, which wasn't known until after World War One was over, if that would, if things would be different. It's hypothesis, of course, but your point about Vietnam is absolutely true.
Well, it's clear from your novel, The Evening News, that you are very fond of television, and you say a number of telling things. For example, the quality continues to climb. The quality of the people involved in broadcast journalism continues to improve. I know that when I came here, which was more than 22 years ago, I was hired. I have always been a broadcaster, and I was hired as a news editor. And we had a horseshoe-shaped newsroom at that time, and I sat in the middle around all of these newspaper people who were hired to be writers for us. There are very few of them left. They were awful, just awful. And we had a hard time finding broadcasters to actually do the job of journalist. We brought them in from newspaper ranks. And some of them were all right, and so we still have a few of them left, but most of them have gone to wherever newspaper people go. But now we have a choice of hiring real broadcast journalists who actually know something about the news and do a good job. And I think you make that point in the book.
I make the point, yes, that generally speaking, television has pioneered in toughness in the news, in investigative reporting, and that the reporters nowadays are more willing to go for the jugular. And because of that, much that in the old days was hidden, concealed, particularly in the political area, now is exposed. And I think I have, I know I have one of my characters saying that this country is nudged because of that a little closer to what it should be.
You say you live in the Bahamas.
Yes, I do.
What about your television reception there? What kind of television do you get?
I have a dish.
Ah.
And I can get everything. Actually, you people at CBS are have created a little bit of a nuisance now because you're scrambling. And so I don't get it direct from the CBS satellite, but I can get it through Primetime 24. And the CBS news we get comes through Chicago, so it's an hour later than I used to get it. Slightly inconvenient.
The stuff that's scrambled, is that the material prior to actual broadcast?
That is the actual feed, yes. You used to be able to watch the anchor having some of his makeup applied or his hair combed, and occasionally there'd be the odd word get out onto the air that they didn't intend to. Actually, ABC is the only one that's not scrambling now. CBS and NBC is, and I suppose ABC will go soon as well.
Well, you can pick up some juicy things from ABC. Pass them on to us, then. Radio also uses satellites now.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
That's why we can have multiple networks. We have, as a matter of fact, it's here at CBS, we have two radio networks. We have it's called Radio, and then the regular CBS radio network, which is really not much. I mean, it's composed mostly of hourly newscasts now. Days of radio networks have pretty well changed. They're not completely gone, of course. There are a lot more networks, in fact, than there used to be, but they work in a different way with a different function. And they, too, use satellites. I don't know if you can pick them up with a dish the way you can.
With an adapter, I could, but I haven't gone into the radio satellites.
Well, tell me where you think, since you know your stuff about television, where do you think television news is going to be heading in the future?
I think it will continue much as it is now. There obviously are changes. Sometimes one has the feeling, particularly on a Friday night, perhaps there's a little more soft news than there should be, and you know what I mean by that. And oftentimes pictures are what cause something to get on the air, a major fire, for example, which is spectacular. And you know darn well that isn't really justified as national news. That gets on. But on the whole, I think the quality is good. And I think while I've been watching network news, it has continued to improve, and I believe that it will. It's competitive.
Where does cable fit into all of this?
Well, of course, cable is fitting in, and I have this in a segment of the story, because the antenna, as we know it, is disappearing, and with cable is going to come access to houses which are not accessible now. And I don't think the networks are going to disappear, but there certainly is going to be more competition. But some of the networks are quietly getting into the cable business.
Well, Arthur Haley, you certainly made the television journalist look good in the evening news, made heroes out of them. The one hero who goes in search of the hostage victims, packing a gun and holding off the rebels and so forth. But that's not unusual. I read someplace that Dan Rather used to pack a pistol.
I didn't know that.
I don't know exactly when and why, but maybe he could have used it. You make reference to the fact that he got into an attack on the Upper East Side of Manhattan some time ago.
I do know that because people have told me that particularly overseas, some correspondents are armed, and nothing is said about it, and it's pretty well left to them whether they are or not. I also know that some feel quite strongly that they shouldn't be and are not.
Well, isn't it true that some people who are identified on their passports as writers have to change that to waiter when they go to some third world country to be on the safe side?
You told me. I didn't know that.
Oh, some writers, you know, some third world.
But I don't
have a great suspicion of journalists and writers. And
my passport doesn't say what my occupation is. Does an American passport say that?
I don't remember. I have one, but I haven't check my passport for a long time. I haven't been out of the country for a long time, so I don't know. But I guess some passports must indicate that. Either that or it's a joke.
Well, I have two passports, a Canadian and a British, and neither one says what my occupation is.
That's probably just as well. Do they ask you, though, when you go through customs?
Sometimes when I come into the United States, U.S. immigration are very friendly, and they say, have you written anything lately? And that's a nice compliment.
Yes, well, you can certainly tell them you have, and it can be purchased at your friendly neighborhood store, the Evening News. Terrific page-turner, Arthur Haley. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.